Welcome to Las Vegas Sun Politics on KUNV. I'm Michael Squires, politics editor at the Sun. Would Republicans be better off with Brian Sandoval as a vice presidential candidate than governor? We'll find out. At least one Clark County commissioner has a high-profile challenger. We'll talk about those races. But first, the state is under fire for failing to provide service to the youngest Nevadans. And joining us to discuss this is David McGrath-Schwartz, who covers state government. David, welcome.
Hey, thanks, Michael.
So what are the accusations against the state?
Well, the state provides a program called Early Intervention Services, and it's for newborns to three-year-olds. And it's services like speech therapy, occupational therapy, physical therapy, to help kids who are struggling. The state provides this service, but this summer they reduced services for a number of children. Not clear how many of the 2,500 kids had their services reduced, but that triggered a complaint which led to an internal investigation. That investigation found some pretty grisly numbers about how well the state is providing those services, and 76% of the cases reviewed by this internal audit, the state was not fully providing the services. It wasn't providing it in a timely manner, and this wasn't in the complaint, but separately, you know, we have about 250 kids on the wait list for these services.
So these services are required, first of all, by the federal government, but seen as very key by the families of these children. Why are they seen as so important?
Well, if you look at some studies, they agree that the youngest children are most receptive to services, that their brains are literally still developing, and that if you get them services and teach them skills and help them with things from cognitive functions on up, it leads to long-term gains as far as they won't need as many services, they might not need services at all from the state or from schools. And so it seems that, you know, and lawmakers and policymakers know this. They've talked about the importance of early childhood development, but they've faced this reality of the budget situation that we're in Nevada.
And what has that budget caused them to do? What are some of the ways that the services have been cut, and specifically what services have been cut?
Sure. So the state contracts out for a lot of their services. The state doesn't pay enough to hire full-time speech therapists or physical therapists, so they contract out, and a lot of times, or this summer, those contracts were capped in how many hours the state would provide those services for, and that seems to be a major one. And another way is the legislature last year made a policy change and said, hey, instead of having these therapists drive to people's houses to provide services, we're going to ask these families to come in, or tell these families to come in, to be more exact, to get services there. That runs afoul of federal law, which says these services have to be provided either at home or in a place where the kids feel comfortable in order so that the children can get the most out of these services.
And we're talking about the speech therapy, physical therapy, that kind of thing, like you say, so as these brains are developing, these young children's brains, mm-hmm. they can better acclimate themselves and hopefully down the road won't require additional services. So given the findings of this investigation and that a complaint had been filed from the state, where does it go from here?
Well, I talked to the attorney who filed the complaint, and she said that they met with the state. They were very satisfied with the interest and the attention being paid by top Health and Human Service state officials, including the director, Mike Wilden. But she conceded that it comes down to money. And if you're looking for the long-term ramifications here, I think that's almost the bigger question here. the governor talked about having a flat budget, and his budget director told agencies that they wouldn't have to cut, and there was some applause in the room. But the question is, you know, what level of services do we provide? We're talking about 0 to 3 year olds, you know, kids with autism, kids with Down syndrome. You know, not to shed my journalistic objectivity, but these are pretty sympathetic cases, and if the state's not providing services to them or limiting services to them, as state officials acknowledge, you got to wonder either what we're spending money on or do we have enough money?
David McGrath-Schwartz covers the state capitol for the Las Vegas Sun. David, thank you for taking the time.
Thanks, Michael.
You're listening to Las Vegas Sun Politics on KUNV. I'm Michael Squires. Joining us now is Anne Jeanette Damon, the Sun's lead political writer. Anne Jeanette, you wrote about this over the weekend, saying that some Republicans think that Brian Sandoval might be of more value to them if he were to, as a vice presidential candidate rather than as a governor and leader of the state party.
Well, I don't know if that's a sentiment necessarily coming from Republicans. It's a concern by some Democrats who are building campaigns, down-ticket campaigns, that will really rely on Obama's turnout efforts to bolster them. Some believe that if Brian Sandoval were named to the national ticket as a vice presidential candidate, I should note at the start, that's a job he's repeatedly said he doesn't want and would turn down. But some wonder if he were to be on the ticket, if the Obama campaign would decide that Nevada was no longer worth competing in, that essentially Brian Sandoval would eliminate Nevada's battleground status in the presidential race because of his popularity. And if that happened, if the Obama campaign pulled out of Nevada, Democrats up and down the ticket would have a much harder time in these split districts. Put another way, Republicans in races from the U.S. Senate, Dean Heller versus Shelley Berkley, to Joe Heck versus John Oseguera, to a handful of races that could determine which party controls the state Senate, the advantage could be thrown to the Republican candidates in those races.
So we're talking about the coattail effect of having a high-profile candidate from one party and I guess the goodwill spilling over to the candidates as down the ticket.
Well, it's not necessarily so much a coattail effect as it is the lack of that turnout machine on the Democratic side. There would be perhaps some, you know, Brian Sandoval would draw Republicans out and you would have that coattail effect. But I think that one of the greater concerns from Democrats would be that their top of the ticket machine would go away.
And that's Obama's team, his campaign has been very effective at getting voters to the polls, at organizing, going back certainly to 2008. So what are Democrats saying about this? They're fearful that Obama would pull out, but what about Sandoval? How strong a candidate do they see him being?
Well, first of all, I should note that strategists who are familiar with Obama's game plan say that the idea of the Obama campaign pulling out of Nevada if Sandoval were on the ticket, they find that laughable. One, because they are eager to actually go at Brian Sandoval in a way that he hasn't been challenged before. He has been incredibly popular from the time he even started considering running. Remember back in 2010, right? All my years are starting to run together. Back in 2010, Republicans were really eager to have a popular Republican get, frankly, Governor Jim Gibbons out of office. They saw Jim Gibbons as, you know, pulling down the party, pulling down the ticket. He was deeply unpopular, could have easily been crushed by a Democrat had he stayed in the race. So Brian Sandoval came in. He left the federal bench. He hadn't been in politics for a long time. He had very little baggage. He's remained popular through that. His race against Rory Reid was not difficult for him, although Rory Reid did spend a fair amount of money going after him in negative ads on television. he never really got much traction, largely because most of the attention was being paid to the U.S. Senate race, Harry Reid versus Sharon Angle. So Brian Sandoval had an easy time, relatively speaking, kind of waltzing through that race. He got into his very first legislative session. It looked like he might have a battle on his hands to get a budget through the legislature, but he was saved from what ultimately could have been an ugly battle there by the Nevada Supreme Court coming in with a decision that really paved the way for an easy agreement to be made on the budget. So, you know, the governor wasn't tested politically there either. So Democrats are looking at this saying, look, if he gets on the ticket, we're going to go after him full bore. We might be able to bring him down a notch on this popularity scale.
So this leads to some of them saying they think he has a glass jaw, to use the boxing terminology, or that he's got kind of a smooth ride and hasn't really been tested politically.
Right. They would be hopeful that should they land a square punch, that that glass jaw would shatter. Now, when you look at Sandoval's record, though, you have to kind of agree with his allies, his consultants, that say there is not a lot to go after the governor on so far. He's been vetted ethically. All of his relationships and dealings have had a fine-tooth comb run over them when he was vetted to be appointed to the federal bench. They say that that's a very rigorous process, that he came through with flying colors. He has, you know, he's raised some ethics questions by the fact that he considered the run for governor before he left the bench. The bench is supposed to be nonpartisan, nonpolitical, and so some have raised questions there. You know, they've tried to attack him on this idea that he's quit most of his jobs. He sees it as moving on up to a greater public service positions.
Run through those jobs, just for those who haven't tracked it as closely.
Sure. He left his term in the Nevada Assembly to go sit on the Gaming Commission. He left his term on the Gaming Commission to run for Attorney General. He left midterm through his first term as Attorney General to be appointed to the federal bench. So, you know, you might say that those were offers that he couldn't necessarily refuse. And it would be really interesting to see if he was offered to run as Vice President of the United States, if he would keep that promise and actually, you know, turn down the offer.
Could one thing be standing in his way be he would be vulnerable to allegations of, hey, or accusations of, hey, look, once again, you're stepping down, you're not finishing out your term just because you want to step up to be the Vice President.
Right, that would fit right into that narrative. And the other thing is, it might, and maybe perhaps this is an unfair comparison because Rick Perry is who Rick Perry is. But Rick Perry, when he decided to run for president, he's Texas governor, he had, you know, soaring Brian Sandoval-like approval ratings in Texas. Republicans in particular loved him, gave him, you know, higher than a 70% approval rating. He went onto the national campaign trail. He stumbled repeatedly, to the embarrassment, I think, of a lot of Texans. He came home after dropping out of the presidential race, and his approval rating sank to 40%. He rivaled President Obama's approval rating in a very Republican state. So, you know, it's not
there? What caused it to drop so bad? I mean, I think people are familiar with some of the gaffes that they saw out of Rick Perry's campaign, but still, you know, that was his home state. That was supposed to be his. Those are his people, so to speak.
Right. Yeah, I think they felt that he kind of abandoned Texas to go run on the national stage, and he embarrassed Texas. When you think of the gas, he, you know, just at every turn, he failed to gain traction. He shot himself in the foot multiple times. He I think, frankly, was an embarrassment to Texans. And his approval rating when he got home showed that, you know, here he is. He left the state when they were facing their own issues and problems that they could use some strong leadership on, and he went on the national campaign trail. You know, that's not to say necessarily that the same fate would befall Sandoval. I think many people believe he would be a little more gifted politically than Rick Perry was. But, you know, that would remain to be seen, too. He hasn't been thrown into that rigorous of a campaign trail himself. But that being said, you know, Brian Sandoval's not up for re-election this year. He's not up until 2014. He wants to maintain this popularity rating. If he wants to remain governor, he could have a pretty easy reelection effort if he plays it right. If he goes onto the campaign trail, depending how things work out, you know, Democrats would be bombarding him weekly. He would be thrown in the mix with whoever the presidential candidate is. Democrats would be beating up the presidential candidate, the vice presidential candidate, Dean Heller, Joe Heck. He would be thrown into that mix. And it's possible his popularity could really take a beating. Now, the converse could be true, too. He could be, since he is so popular and he has proven to be a pretty gifted politician, people trust him, people know him. The converse could be true, and he could be good for the Republican ticket, despite Democratic efforts to beat him up.
So at this point, this is speculation, but on an issue that's important enough that a lot of consultants out there are kind of playing it out or putting the scenarios, testing them to see how they would respond, correct?
Yeah, there are some. I don't know how widespread that is, but I have had conversation with at least one Democratic consultant who has multiple clients up and down the ticket, local races, state races, who said that had to be kind of at least a potential scenario that he had to anticipate just in case it came to fruition. Although, you know, I think that it's kind of fun to talk about and interesting to look at all the different scenarios. But when it comes down to it, it's probably a very small likelihood that Governor Sandoval would be on the national ticket. Not to put to waste this entire conversation that we've had.
To negate the last 10 minutes. So you've also written about a corruptibility study, people looking at state governments. Talk about that. What did they find?
This was actually a pretty intensive investigation by three national groups that set out to find a standardized way to risk, to measure the corruption risk of states across the nation. They looked at all 50 states. They rated them on 15 different indicators and found that, drumroll please, and this should probably not surprise too many people, Nevada is number 9 when it comes to corruptibility. Nevada received a D- on this investigation. It's called the State Integrity Investigation. It was done by the Global Integrity organization, Center for Public Integrity and Public Radio International, and they found that Nevada falls down in many areas from having a strong independent auditing agency, having transparency on the pension fund, on redistricting, on budgets. Our strongest score was in procurement, that there's some pretty strong safeguards and accountability and transparency
when it comes to bidding contracts and such.
Bidding and contracts and that kind of stuff, yeah. But in almost every other area, Nevada scored very poorly.
Of course, we in the media are always in favor of more transparency. It certainly gives us a clearer view of the things that we report on. What are the barriers, I guess, at the government level and among elected officials, or the hesitancy that we sometimes see? Where does that come from?
Well, it could be self-preservation in a lot of cases. But I think one of the interesting findings from this report was not necessarily that states, and this is kind of a broad brush description by those who conducted the investigation, that states don't necessarily have weak or lax laws on the books. In many cases, states have strong laws, strong mechanisms for guarding against corruption, but the enforcement was rather weak, that there's an enforcement gap, either because there's political interference or because politicians don't fund adequately, that resources are very poor in a lot of these states for making sure that elected officials and not just elected officials, but public servants are adhering to the laws that are in place. So the investigators found that there probably won't be a lot of changing of the laws, that if states really want to affect greater transparency and accountability, that they need to put resources towards enforcing the laws they have on their books.
And that's usually where the legislature is sometimes hesitant to allocate the resources to do that. What in some of the instances, the person who should be looking into it is like the Secretary of State. For people who aren't filing campaign contribution reports or financial disclosure forms. And this can sometimes lead to accusations that the Attorney General the Secretary of State is an elected official. Sometimes people are saying, well, it's politically motivated. It's a Democrat going after Republicans or vice versa. Does that sometimes stand in the way, you think, of getting the transparency, because people think it'll be carried out in a political way?
Yeah, I think that that's definitely a danger. You know, Nevada also has an ethics commission that is nonpartisan and that looks into a lot of these things. You know, back to the point about elected officials worried about their own self-preservation and being their own worst watchdogs, the legislature, for example, has exempted itself from the public meeting law and from a lot of open records laws. So, you know, when you do put those elected officials in charge of their own accountability and watchdog efforts, it's kind of like the fox guarding the hen house.
Anjanette Damon is the Sun's lead political writer. Anjanette, thank you. We'll be watching to see if anyone picks up on this story and goes with it and maybe get some better, more transparent laws here.
All right. Thank you very much.
Joining us now is Joe Shaneman.
Hello, Michael.
Covers Clark County for the Las Vegas Sun. Joe, welcome. We wanted to talk to you about some of the commission races coming up. Steve Sisolak, there have been talk of him being challenged by the firefighters because he's been a strident, I guess, advocate for looking at the sick leave, which some had seen was being abused by the firefighters. Is he going to have a challenger?
He will have a challenger. I don't think a challenger has a chance against him. He's raised $1.2 million against somebody from the Independent American Party. I believe the guy's name is Brassfield or Brassman. That may be the most notice he gets in this race or in the history of Nevada because he's just not going to have a chance. Sisolak's in the news all the time. He's done works that have made people recognize him as a potential gubernatorial candidate one day, maybe U.S. Senate candidate. He's just, I think he's pretty unstoppable right now. Even this recent spat with his ex-girlfriend, Kathleen Vermillion, it came up. She made allegations against him. He charged back. She dropped her allegations, dropped her lawsuit, and it's disappeared. It's basically gone.
You talk about him possibly running for governor, for Senate. What does he say when he's asked about that?
He said, for governor, if Sandy, that'd be Mr. Sandoval, Governor Sandoval, if Sandoval doesn't do a good job, he didn't define what that means, but he said if he doesn't do a good job, he'd probably run. As for U.S. Senate, people, including Republicans, and Sisolak's a Democrat, were asking last year for him to run. Not just people from Nevada, Californians are asking him to do so. You know, that might be in the offing, but he doesn't really talk about
Californians
it.
Are asking? Mm-hmm, well, Californians.
Yeah. California business people. I don't know why. He's just sought out by a lot of people, largely because of his stance against, he's a Democrat, but he's a centrist. He's down the middle. He's socially liberal, but he's very financial or fiscally conservative, and he doesn't like the huge salaries that Clark County firefighters, even police, or most government workers in Clark County, they have much larger salaries than other governments around the country. Although we have fewer government employees per 1,000 people, but they do have higher salaries, and he's rallied against that and railed against it.
That seems to have been his trademark issue, one that seems to have made him quite popular with a group of people. Okay, Larry Brown, it looks like he's kind of in a similar situation where he's drawn some challengers, but no one really with the capability of fundraising or gaining support to really mount a big challenge. Is that safe to say?
Yeah, I don't see what – it'd be hard to say what the issues against Brown are other than the fact that he's a Democrat on an all-Democratic board right now. He's very thoughtful. I watch him every week. He's a very thoughtful county commissioner.
He's always had a reputation as someone who would actually take the time to go through the budget, kind of line by line.
Yeah, he does do that. He doesn't. He's not a haranguer. He doesn't put people on the spot. He's very methodical in the way he goes about his business. I think he's probably appreciated by government workers for that. It'll be interesting to see what kind of issues they bring up. Like, what can they say about him? There's no scandals out there, I don't think. I mean, what can they say to bring disrepute to him or to challenge him? It'll be interesting.
Okay, but Tom Collins, the other county commissioner who's up for reelection, he has drawn kind of a higher profile challenger, Ruth Johnson, who was a member of the Clark County School Board for years. What is being said about this race at this point? How is this shaping up?
Well, Ruth Johnson just filed yesterday, and Collins has some baggage. Gosh, where do I begin? I mean, he just does. He's come off through his comments. He's sort of always been this way. He's the cowboy commissioner. He's come off in his commentaries as being a loose cannon, very supportive of firefighters. Just yesterday at a meeting, he recommended hire another salary increase for Pat Mulroy, and Steve Sislak countered, "We don't have any money." This was during her evaluation. I mean, people don't like that. I mean, that it's truly the way he feels. But this, when people are 200,000 people have lost their jobs in Nevada, people don't like to hear that. We want to give somebody who makes 200,000 or more even more money, even though she's done a good job.
But he has been in office for years and years. Was in the legislature for a long time. Then when he was term limited out there, or didn't run for re-election, he then ran for the commission and won. I mean, he's enough of a name, though, that don't you think people know who he is and maybe feel comfortable with him?
People know who he is, but they know Ruth Johnson. And I know this does play a factor, I think, in his district. He's Mormon, and he covers Logandale and some of those other...
That's Mormon communities.
Mormon community, Mormon, but so yeah. Is Ruth Johnson. And, I think it's going to be a battle of character. She's who's going to come off as the more stable? She's a Republican as well.
How much does party politics play in this? Because, I mean, they are partisan races, but it's local government.
Yeah, but it's become an important issue. People tend to think that this all Democratic board is more sympathetic to labor. And at a time when, like I said before, people are losing their jobs, people aren't attuned to being sympathetic to labor.
So you see it's maybe a similar demographic that you hear people saying about the legislature, where the assembly is overwhelmingly Democratic. The Senate's pretty close, two seats one way or the other. And some people, at least in the business community, are saying they would like to see a Republican state Senate to kind of balance out, to temper things in the legislature, so it's one party doesn't completely get its own way.
Yeah, I think that's the perception out there. The commission does have sort of a token Republican in Sisolak, maybe a very moderate Republican, Brown.
But Sisolak's a registered Democrat.
He is, but he's...
You're saying he's a conservative. He's more of an old school...
He's a businessman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But Joe, you have reported recently that the Regional Transportation Commission is looking at raising bus fares in the Valley. Now, why is that? It seems like they've had a fare increase recently in 2010.
Well, you raise the fares enough, you get the ne'er-do-wells off the buses. No, it's they're still $8.3 million short in their in expenses over revenue, so they got to make it up. And they had formed a committee last October, this committee, which is made up of groups from every swath of life, every little nook and cranny of Las Vegas, came up with a bunch of suggestions for fare increases.
Including, fortunately, a couple of people who actually ride the bus, right?
Yeah, including people who ride the bus. Most of the fare increases are going to happen in the paratransit area. Mm-hmm. That is, people who get door-to-door service because they can't use the fixed routes that they have because of disabilities.
The smaller vehicles you see driving around.
Yeah, you use those small vehicles you see driving breakneck down the highway and cutting you off, because that's happened to me. That's happened to me once.
Okay, so you say most of the fare increase would come from paratransit. The RTC is required by the Americans with Disabilities Act to provide this service.
Without funding.
They are reimbursed, though, by the state and through some federal grants for providing the service. But it's pretty expensive. They said... it costs about, what, $38 for a ride?
$37 for one-way trip. Uh-huh. And I think the cost per ride, the cost that somebody, the paratransit customer pays $2 and something, mm-hmm. but the rest is reimbursed by the state. And and complying with the ADA requirements opens the gates for grants for other things, too. So that's why they want to be a part of it.
Okay. But one of the ways they're going to save money is, and this goes back to when I was covering transportation, They'll pick up anybody who's within a mile and a half of a fixed bus route. So the 206 on Charleston or whatever, you're within a mile and a half of that, your apartment or home or whatever. Mm-hmm. They'll come and get you and take you on one of these rides. They're going to make that a smaller area.
Yeah, they made that a smaller area 2 years ago, but they grandfathered in people who had used it previously. They turned it to 0.75 miles or 0.75 miles 2 years ago. Now everybody's going to be at 0.75 miles. I don't know the specifics. I wrote them, but I can't remember them.
It's about 0.75, 0.75 miles.
Right. Yeah. They're jacking up the passes, the cost of passes for that kind of thing. They're going to be increasing by, I think, a quarter the regular bus fares for fixed route riders, mm-hmm. and a whole host of other things. Jacob Snow, the outgoing RTC general manager, mildly spoke out against it.
What did he say?
He said that their last increase was just 2 weeks ago. He didn't think people that it was a good idea to do just yet. They didn't have a really broad discussion about it. There are going to be 10 public hearings where people can bring up their support or their dislike of the ideas, and then they'll make their final decision.
So you say he's on the way out. He's going to become Henderson city manager. Is this something you think he would have said if he were staying?
Yeah, I do. Actually, so it was kind of touching. I don't use that word ever, I don't think. But he came when he was saying his goodbyes, and they're going to have another special meeting, I think, for him to say a formal goodbye. Some rider came up and said, "We love you, Jacob," and then just sat down. Mm-hmm. And he almost got tearful.
Really? Well, he has been there since, I think...
13 years.
99, yeah. Long time covering that as general manager of RTC. And the bus, you say there are 10 public hearings coming up. Was there any sense from the people who were there when it was first proposed at this meeting of what the response is going to be? Any inkling of what that is? Are people... Oh, of course, they don't want to pay more money, but if you can't bridge this deficit, I'm assuming... At some point, you don't have a bus system either. So,
Yeah, if they don't bridge that deficit, they talked briefly about cutting services in the outlying areas, Mesquite and Laughlin, and places that a lot of Las Vegans probably don't care about. But they talked about that, and obviously those people out in the hustings are going to care about it. It's going to be a real battle. I mean, I don't know. It's the fees are going up for everything. We got water; they're jacking up water prices, electricity. Now we got bus fares. I mean, as you stated recently, when does it end?
Joe Shaneman covers Clark County government for the Las Vegas Sun. Thank you, Joe.
Yeah, well, you're very welcome, Michael.
Joe Shaneman covers Clark County for the Las Vegas Sun. Anjanette Damon is the paper's lead political writer, and David McGrath Schwartz covers the state capitol. You can follow their coverage and the rest of the Sun Politics team at lasvegassun.com/politics. I'm Michael Squires. Have a good day.